Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. All right, cliche alert, but there's actually a good reason why. I'm about to tell you that I loved reading Brave New World when I was a kid, mostly because Aldous Huxley's dark dystopia, where society has abolished natural reproduction in favor of artificially raising human embryos in hatcheries, it just seems so wildly impossible. However, Huxley set Brave New World in the year 2540. Here we are in the year 2016, and Harvard genetics professor George Church is telling us that in the near future, we will be able to synthesize an entire human genome from scratch. That such a future is not wildly impossible, but highly probable, and that Huxley got the phrase right, but the meaning wrong. It will be a brave new world, but brave in the best sense, not the worst. Well, recently, WBUR Common Health editor Kerry Goldberg had an extensive conversation with George Church about genomics advances coming in both the near and long terms, and the profound ethical questions that come with that. And she joins us now with more. Hi there, Kerry.
Hey, Meghna. And I know just how you feel, that it's incredible that this thing that was science fiction when we were kids is now possible. It's within the realm of the doable.
Exactly. And I mean, Huxley was looking at the year 2500. He was 500 years off, it seems. Okay, so tell us about your sit down with George Church. First of all, he's a major figure in the world of genomics. Who is he?
Yes, he really is. He's a towering figure. Actually, literally, he's towering. He's like 6'5 with a big white beard, but mainly he's a towering figure in science. He's been at the cutting edge of genetic engineering and sequencing the genome for about as long as it's been a big field. He's founded a bunch of companies, and he's renowned as really a brilliant scientist. And so when he says things like, hey, you know, we could bring back the Neanderthals or the mammoths, it's like de-extinction, or we could edit the human genome to eradicate terrible diseases, then people tend to listen. Now, remember, he's not necessarily saying we should do it, but he's saying we could. We could do it. And also, Meghna, he's extraordinarily open. Like, he's even got his own genome posted publicly. He's just right out there as a matter of principle. He believes that science should be transparent.
I've proposed some of the most open projects, like the Open Humans, open software hardware for sequencing. I myself am part of Open Humans.
Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a moment. But let's actually start our conversation in a more sort of down-to-earth place that you also talked to George Church about. It's about a project to release genetically engineered mice into the wild in order to stop the spread of Lyme disease. And this is actually a proposal that's on the table or maybe even in the works for Nantucket and soon will be in Martha's Vineyard. So how does it work?
Right. So just to clarify, this isn't actually George Church's project. It's his mentees, but he talked about it. And also, this is just in the very, very earliest stages of being proposed. Okay. It all depends on public approval and, of course, how the science goes. But yes, right. So the story is, well, first of all, pop quiz, Meghna. What organism causes Lyme disease?
There's a bacterium, right?
Yes, that's right. What spreads the bacterium?
Okay, so what's the deer ticks?
Yes, deer ticks. But so, and most of us know that deer ticks are connected with deer, right? Because deer ticks. But what a lot of people don't know is that the Lyme disease bacterium has a very complicated life cycle, and part of it involves mice. What happens is that the bacteria don't infect the baby ticks, the newborn ticks, but in their larval stage, the newborn ticks feed off mice, and they can catch it from the mice. So the mice are like a reservoir for the bacteria. So now we get to the proposal. So there's an MIT evolutionary biologist, Kevin Esvelt, who studied under George Church, and he's proposing to try to genetically engineer many, many thousands of mice so that they'd carry antibodies against the Lyme bacterium. So they'd be resistant, right, to the Lyme bug. And by the way, these are based on genes that have already evolved naturally in some mice. So it's not putting foreign DNA into the mice necessarily.
And so that would interrupt the life cycle somehow? Is that the hope?
Exactly, right. So you get resistant mice and then you spread them around. He's proposing first to try it on an uninhabited island and see how that goes. And then if it works and if the community approves, then you could try releasing them on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and see if that helps, because both those islands have just hideous Lyme disease problems. And then if all that goes well, then years down the line, you could maybe release genetically engineered mice much more broadly on the mainland and possibly with more sort of powerful engineering that would help these resistance genes spread.
Okay, so this is a proposal or a project from one of George Church's mentees, as you said. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to me, it sounds like it would be great to stop worrying about Lyme,
yes.
But there are always unintended consequences.
Right. And that's why they're putting this out there early and they're asking the public, hey, this looks probable. Do you want to do this? And I asked George Church what he thinks of this proposal of his mentee, Kevin Esfeld. He says he's personally for it.
Yeah, I have a house in Connecticut and my family was definitely voting in favor. They can't wait to be able to spend more time there.
It has wrecked the outdoors. Yeah.
But no matter how enthusiastic we all are personally, the important thing is to also make sure that it's done carefully and with great public awareness and engagement so that you can see every step of the way how we're doing the ecological studies, how we're doing the kind of contained studies of the gene drive, and so on, so that they can make up their mind at any moment to pull the plug or to change the direction.
And how doable is the manipulation that he's talking about? How soon would that even be plausible?
Well, so gene drives have now worked in every species that's been seriously tried in. I don't think they're working in mice yet, but certainly in insects and fungal species. But anyway, this could happen within a year where we're getting these serious field trials. But again, it depends on not just the technical progress, but the societal discussions that go around it.
Because, Meghna, you can imagine what they're talking about is altering the shared environment, and we all better have a say in what happens.
Yeah. Right? Well, mm-hmm. We are talking with WBUR's Common Health editor, Carrie Goldberg, about George Church, the Harvard geneticist, who has some very interesting proposals about directions that genomics research could go, both in the long term and the near term. And we're also going to talk about the sort of ethical considerations around that. So, Carrie, hang on mm-hmm. for just a second, because I want to introduce someone else into the conversation, Lori Zoloth. She's a professor of medical humanities and bioethics and a professor of religious studies at Northwestern University. She's been thinking a lot about the ethical considerations around gene-based research. She joins us now. Professor Zoloth, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, really, I know your area of expertise is in how we tinker with the human genome, and we're going to get to that in a second. But I did want your reaction to the sort of nearer-term example of how we could use genomics research in our immediate environment vis-a-vis these hopefully Lyme disease-resistant mice. What do you think?
So I actually heard Kevin Esfeld give this paper in December of this year, and I was fascinated by it, as the entire room was, because it uses the mouse, not the tick, as the target, right? So the reason turns out to be that mice have much shorter reproductive cycles than ticks, which live longer
yeah, who
and
knew?
More slowly. Who knew? Who knew? Right? So, and then I thought deer had to be involved, but oh no, it's the mice. So he's doing several things that make this ethically interesting and defensible. The first, of course, is he's having public discussions with people who will be most dramatically affected, the inhabitants of the islands mm-hmm. that are going to be test cases for his idea. He's first doing on an uninhabited island, and he's secondly asking the people that interact with that ecosystem what they think about this dramatic change. Now, it seems simple, but what you're doing is making mice more powerful in a sense. They can resist this disease. It could go very well. Let's hope that it does. And I'm glad he's doing it in slow steps with consent. It could, of course, as I said to Professor Esfeld, it could, of course, destroy the ecosystem in some unintended way that he has no idea will happen. That's why you tested first with very few species on a very contained space.
Well, can I just jump in here and ask you a quick question? Because I feel like you've just gotten to what is sort of one of the heart of the matter when it comes to any of this research, whether it be on mice or on humans. And that's this question of how should science and researchers deal with considerations of unintended consequences? I mean, I know that there's a very strong argument that the science and scientists themselves are just focused on the science, and we as society have to think about the unintended consequences. But certainly, how do we have that discussion? Where should that discussion begin?
Well, let's begin with understanding that some consequences will be unintended and are completely unknown. Therefore, it has to be worth it to take that sort of chance with humanity, even with an island in the middle of the Atlantic, right? It has to be worth it. So Lyme disease is an enormously important problem, especially for people who live on the East Coast. It does change how humans relate to the outdoors, and when you get serious cases of Lyme disease can be devastating. So it seems like the people who are most affected could make that decision for themselves and for their island. Whether it should be widely spread up and down the East Coast, that's another sort of question. And maybe we would like to spend some time going slowly through this process and seeing what the effects are. Of course, the long-term and generational effects can't be known. If the mice are more resistant to this disease, does that give them immunity to something else? What happens if the mice population overgrows? Then how do we have to intervene? But those things, if they're taken slowly, can be handled piece by piece, again, with the consent of the people on the island.
Right.
But that's why using gene drives for, say, malaria, to me, seems much more important and much more ethically sound, right? Because that's a devastating disease. Every 30 minutes, someone, usually a child, dies of malaria. Even as we speak here on this program, reflecting upon it, actual children are dying at a terrible rate.
Yeah. So let me just jump in here.
You can use there.
Yeah, let me just jump in here for a second because you used the word slowly, but the question is the science is going ever faster, and I want to actually use that to turn to this other idea, Carrie, that George Church has about synthesizing a human genome, and that could be coming somewhere down the line. So first of all, what does George Church mean when he says that?
So George Church is talking about not just reading or sequencing the existing human genome, the full set of our genes, but actually writing a human genome, meaning that you would build it. You're not just reading it, you're actually creating it. So the idea is you would build a full set of human genes from scratch, the way you would make a, I mean, it's not completely from nothing. It's like if you make a cake from scratch, you have the eggs and the sugar and the flour. But you could basically manufacture our blueprint from chemicals and conceivably create a human being without parents. And so I think of it as, you know, it's not just in vitro fertilization. It's like in vitro genesis or in vitro creation, which, of course, it's, you know, it's fun to think about. It's wild. It's maybe like playing God in the lab. But it's that, according to George Church, is not the point. He says that actually it could make sense scientifically.
Let's say you wanted to change the genetic code so that you can make a cell line for manufacturing drugs, vaccines, antibodies, and so forth. That manufacturing, if you wanted to be the virus resistant, changing the genetic code is one way of doing that. And if you change the genetic code of every protein in the cell, in the genome, you might as well have synthesized the whole genome. That's our experience in bacteria, where we've done exactly that.
So basically what you're saying is the technology was at the point where it was time to start talking about doing this, right? And I gather the timescale could be within a few years.
Yeah,
could
I mean, to some extent, we're already doing it. We're synthesizing bigger and bigger genomes. And I like to bring up these things as far in advance as you can, although it seems like we're driving faster through the fog than ever before. We're getting a little ahead of our headlights. So it could be 5 years, 10 years before we've brought the price down so that anybody can basically synthesize any large genome that they want. And it's time to be thinking not just about the technological implications and commercial, but also ethical and societal implications.
Let's talk about those. What's the conversation that you would like to be beginning now about the societal and ethical implications?
Well, we've already had some of these conversations, but it's just good to just renew them and refresh and ask if there's something new. I mean, for example, we've had conversations about consent of cells, you know, sort of the HeLa cells. Rebecca Skloot brought this to many people's attention.
And then there's the sci-fi aspect, right, which is you sort of start thinking, so you could create a human from scratch.
I have nothing against sci-fi, especially if it's approaching reality. The way that we're currently configuring the project has nothing to do with this, first of all, but it's okay to talk beyond the project. Even in the most radically engineered genomes, it's not like we make random bases of A, C's, T's, and G's. You know, it's based on something, and whoever that closest person is effectively a parent. I saw some ethicist, I can't remember who it was, saying that the problem with parentless children is that they have no history, they have no richness of inheritance. But, you know, this kind of condemns whole lot of people who are orphans and or otherwise put up for adoption. And I think that it's not that fundamental a bit of humanity is that you know who your parents are.
Well, that's George Church. He's one of the nation's leading geneticists and a Harvard University professor, speaking with WBUR's Carrie Goldberg. My head is swimming, Carrie.
It's
with
pretty wild.
All the possibilities.
Yeah. It's pretty wild. Now, of course, it will be years and years, but still, it raises these crazy questions. Like one of my favorite ones that was in an essay was, well, so should we build a bunch of Einsteins then? How many Einsteins do we want?
Yeah, my starting the segment with Brave New World seems actually apt because it feels like we're there. Let's turn back now again to Lori Zola. She's a professor of medical humanities and bioethics at Northwestern University. Professor Zola, we heard George Church sort of outline some of where he would think that the ethical center of gravity lies in the synthetic human genome research that he's proposing. I mean, you heard him there mention the question of consent. Is that one of the more important questions to you?
This is a very different discussion than the discussions we've had previously about genetic engineering, where we think about a disease, we think about the genetic cause, we think about using, say, one of those new techniques like CRISPR-Cas9 to make changes in an existing genome, or stem cell research, where you think about creating a line of stem cells that would be useful for patching up parts of the organisms, right? This is an ontologically different project of taking chemicals that you order online from a lab and string them together to make a human genome, or to make any genome. In fact, you just had a chilling discussion about the use of assault guns as weapons, and this is very close to the room in which people talk about making biological bacteria, not just cheerful, friendly ones, but dangerous ones, mm-hmm. right? So this is technology that has to be very carefully thought through, regulated, and you have to ask the ethical question of the nature, goal, and meaning of this work in general. Why we give scientists so much money and attention and praise, and why we honor them so much, is because they're after a quest to end human suffering or to alleviate human suffering. So therefore, they have enormous capacities, but they have to use them very carefully and only after the kind of public discourse and public discussion that I know George Church is interested in. When you're driving ahead of your headlights, you better slow down because it's not safe, especially to other people who happen to be in your way. And it's only barely excusable if you're rushing to save a life. But in this case, we're developing a technology with no immediate use that couldn't be done better with genetic manipulation and genetic modification of existing genomes.
Let me ask you, this is maybe an echo of my earlier question, but it's kind of the one that I really fundamentally grapple with. Is how much of the responsibility should we be putting on scientists, right? Because, I mean, I'm thinking back to the many scientists who work to split the atom, right? I mean, one could say that absolutely they knew what the goal was. The goal was to build a bomb that could split the atom. But at the time, they were also saying, well, our fundamental job as basic scientists and researchers is simply to expand human knowledge. And it's up to society to decide how that knowledge is then put into place and used in practice. So, you know, when you said that we revere scientists and we give them an extraordinary amount of power, I mean, aren't we as society equally powerful in deciding when to slow the car down with the headlights analogy?
So that's a good story, because that bomb was developed in a situation of war, and it was only justifiable to stop a war that was slaughtering millions and millions of people. And that's the only justification for that. It's a shaky justification even in retrospect, right? But the thought came after of how to regulate this powerful technology, and it was from a strong social movement, both from within scientists themselves, scientists who were concerned about their social responsibility, and from without. You know, Mothers Against Nuclear Weapons, a mainstay of the 1960s anti-nuclear movement. Maybe it went too far. We can actually say, gee, maybe if we had developed nuclear technology instead of using carbon fuel, maybe we'd be in a different situation now, for, you know, facing catastrophic global warming. But at least we paid attention to the just concerns that this would be a weapon of war that would be ending an entire planet.
Right.
And that planetary view is what these big discussions bring forward, and that's why we have to have them about this kind of interesting but radical technology of creating a new human genome.
Well, on that point, and just briefly, because we're flat out of time here, but I want just to ask you both, Carrie and Lori, there have been some conversations specifically around the synthetic genome project that's been proposed, but they've been behind closed doors. Lori Zoloth, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
There was one meeting, and it was an unusual meeting because it was by invitation only. But the thing that made it unusual was that people were prohibited from speaking to the press, and that was our concern. Usually science meetings such as this can be accounted for. You say, yes, we're going to this meeting, and it's by invitation only, but it's not a secret. And so, but we've moved on beyond that concern, and now you're having a discussion, the two of you, the three of us, with George, and we're looking forward to broadening that discussion in the coming months and inviting many more people into the conversation, and I hope you join us.
And Carrie, would you join those conversations?
I would want a front row seat, I think, just because, you know, I feel like this is one of the most interesting intersections between science and society of our time. Like, there are some historians who write that the thing that's one of the things that's the most unique about now is that we humans are gaining the ability to take direct control of evolution. So, like, wow, but yikes.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can read her post about exactly what's been proposed for Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and more about George Church as well. We've got a link to that at radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you.
Welcome.
And Lori Zoloth, professor of medical humanities and bioethics and professor of religious studies at Northwestern University. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to the conversation, and I hope it continues.
Same as do I. And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Let us know what you think about the ethics around genomics research. Send us a comment at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.